Well, this presentation is based on a paper that I wrote recently, and that I have been discussing with colleagues in different universities here in the U.S. And in this paper, I defend the following four theses. The first one is that the dominant discourse for describing, evaluating, and regulating indigenous groups is constituted by a strong but contingent alliance between multicultural liberalism and what I would like to call the indigenous anthropological model. Multicultural liberalism identifies indigenous groups with as national minorities and argue in favor of granting them an important number of cultural rights, more specifically of group differentiated rights. The indigenous anthropological model gives specific content to Indian identity, and the key category in this way of interpreting indigenous groups' identities, and more precisely in identity in singular, is the concept of territory. The second thesis is that this alliance between liberal multiculturalism and the indigenous model has determined the way in which international law and many legal systems in liberal democracies that regulate matters related to indigenous groups. Think, for example, in ILO Convention 169, think in the jurisprudence of the Inter-American Court, and think in the jurisprudence of the Colombian Constitutional Court that has been particularly progressive on matters related to cultural diversity and more precisely on matters related to indigenous groups. The third thesis states that the dominant discourse that describes, evaluates, and regulates indigenous groups has important descriptive, analytical, and normative limits. From my point of view, this discourse essentializes, territorializes, and homogenizes Indian identity. This discourse also obscures the fact that around half of those that identify themselves as Indians live in urban settings. Think, for example, that in Mexico, approximately 30% of the Indian population lives in cities, 50% in Canada, and 75% in Australia. In New Zealand, 83% of the Maori live in urban contexts, and half of the Indians that live in Brazil live in urban areas. In Chile, around 70% of those who are recognized as Indian live in towns and cities, and around 27% of this population live in Santiago. Today, 61% of U.S. and 21% of Colombian Indians do not inhabit their ancestral territories, but instead live in urban contexts such as Denver and Bogotá. Think that Denver has an Indian population of around 42,000, while Bogotá has one of around 15,000. The fourth and last thesis that I defend in the paper is that in order to include the diversity that exists within indigenous groups, we need a new set of conceptual tools. And I offer a typology that I think might help to recognize this diversity that exists within indigenous groups. And there are three main categories within this typology. The first one is what I call traditional urban Indians. The second one is what I call metropolitan Indians. And the third one is what I call urban Indians in transit. Now, in order to elaborate on these four theses, I would like to divide my presentation in two parts. In the first part, I would like to present the basic structure of liberal multiculturalism and the indigenous anthropological model. In the second part, I would like to discuss the theoretical and practical challenges posed by urban Indians to liberal multiculturalism and to the indigenous anthropological model. In this second part, I will also want to present the typology that would help us recognize and describe in more precise ways the diversity that exists within Aboriginal groups. Now, first part, liberal multiculturalism. From my point of view, the basic idea defended by multicultural liberals is that group differentiated rights are compatible with autonomy and equality. And this basic idea can be subdivided in three parts. The first one is that the first idea defended by liberal multiculturalists in this matter is that autonomy is not exercised in a vacuum. It is exercised in particular contexts that offer a range of alternatives and the value that each of these alternatives have. If autonomy, multicultural liberals argue, should be protected, then culture should also be protected. The second idea defended by multicultural liberals in this context is related to the fact that in order to allow minorities to protect themselves from the undue interference of the cultural majority and diminish the imbalance of power that exists between cultural minorities and cultural majorities, we need cultural rights, more precisely, group-differentiated rights. In this way, multicultural liberals defend group-differentiated rights in as much as they are a fundamental tool, a fundamental instrument to defend the value of equality. The third idea defended by multicultural liberals in this context is that in order to protect autonomy and equality, we need three types of rights. The first type is self-government rights. The second type is special representation rights. And the third type is what some call special cultural rights. Lastly, multicultural liberals connect these ideas with indigenous groups in the following way. For most of multicultural liberals, indigenous groups should be identified with national minorities. And the content of this category of national minorities is the following. These are collectivities that inhabit an ancestral territory, that speak specific languages, that have a common past, and that want to remain as a different cultural community from the majority. So we see here that there are some general theoretical ideas defended by multicultural liberalism that are connected to the specific interests and rights of indigenous groups. Again, the key issue here is that for multicultural liberalism, indigenous groups should be described as national minorities, and in that way should be granted group-differentiated rights, particularly self-government rights and special representation rights. Now, this model, this political philosophy model, has been historically, although not conceptually, allied with what I call the anthropological indigenous model. This model gives content to Indian identity using the following six categories. First, to be Indian, to be a real Indian, is to inhabit an ancestral territory. Second, this territory is rural. Third, this territory is constituted mainly by wild nature. Fourthly, these indigenous communities, these real, these true Indian communities are committed to atavic cultural practices inescapably linked to a territory. This model also defends the idea that indigenous communities have subsistence economies in order to protect the holistic relationship that they have with nature. And lastly, this model argued that indigenous communities want to remain a different cultural community from the majority. The following two quotes, I believe, summarize in illustrative ways this indigenous anthropological model. Chief Seattle points out that our spiritual belief is that we were created as part of the earth. In this way, our identity, our names, our songs are all linked to the earth. Similarly, the Embera leader, Rojas Birri, indigenous community from Colombia, states that the ethnic group requires the territory on which it has settled in order to survive and to develop its culture. This presupposes the recognition of the right to property on settled traditional territories and those that make up its habitat. Now, from my point of view, this indigenous anthropological model territorializes Indian identity. To be an Indian, therefore, is to live in a particular territory. Identity does not travel with the subject. This model also ecologizes Indian identity. Indians are identified with a holistic view of nature where human beings are just one part of it. Human beings are not the owners of nature. They exist to protect it. Indians, thus, have subsistence economies. This model also essentializes Indian identity. There is no difference between indigenous groups that lived in pre-European times and the indigenous groups of today. It seems that for this model, indigenous groups have lived in some kind of eternal present. Indigenous groups have been, are, and will be the same. Indian identity does not transform itself. And finally, this indigenous model also homogenizes Indian identity. This model obscures the diversity that exists within indigenous groups. Now, this alliance, again historical, not conceptual, and purely contingent between liberal multiculturalism and the indigenous anthropological model, has influenced in a very strong way international law and the legal systems of many liberal democracies that recognize cultural diversity. So think, for example, in ILO Convention 169. Article 4 of this convention states that special measures shall be adopted as appropriate for safeguarding the cultures and environment of the peoples concerned. Article 6 recognizes the right to prior consultation to all indigenous people. Article 9 recognizes indigenous jurisdiction in matters in criminal matters. And Article 13, that is part of the title on territory, argues that, states that in applying the provisions of this part of the convention, governments shall respect the special importance, spiritual values that the cultures concerned grant their lands or territories, or both as applicable, which they occupy or otherwise use, and in particular the collective aspects of this relationship. In the same way, the most important cases issued by the Inter-American Court, Aguastigny versus Nicaragua, Saramaca versus Suriname, and Moiwana versus Suriname, cases related to issues that are important for Aboriginal communities in the Americas, are strongly influenced by this alliance between liberal multiculturalism and the indigenous anthropological model. Think, for example, what the court says in Aguastigny. Among indigenous peoples, there is a community tradition regarding a communal form of collective property of the land, in the sense that ownership of the land is not centered on an individual, but rather on the group and its community. Indigenous groups, because of their very existence, have the right to live freely in their own territory. The close ties Indians have with the land must be recognized and understood as the fundamental basis of their cultures, their spiritual life, their integrity, and their economic survival. For indigenous communities, relations with the land are not merely a matter of possession and production, but a material and a spiritual element with which they must fully enjoy, even to preserve their cultural legacy and to transmit it to future generations. Now, I'm not saying that the model per se is problematic. I'm not saying that the indigenous anthropological model does not describe certain indigenous groups. What I'm arguing is that this model, in alliance with liberal multiculturalism, obscures an important part of the life of indigenous groups, an important part of the diversity of indigenous groups. Now, this alliance is important also because, on the one hand, it justifies within the dominant political philosophy in the Western world, that is liberalism, group-differentiated rights. So this discourse, liberal multicultural multicultural liberalism makes compatible group differentiated rights with the main discourse in the majority of the polities in the Western world, and therefore opens the possibility of liberal democracies granting rights that are fundamental for protecting the interests and needs of Aboriginal communities all over the world. This alliance between liberal multiculturalism and the indigenous model is also important because it defines who is the other that can legitimately claim these rights, these group-differentiated rights. And it is useful in as much as law needs a stable subject of rights to protect values like equality and predictability. Think that when we are talking about group-differentiated rights, we're talking about distributive justice. We're talking about the distribution of scarce resources. And in order to do that, law needs a very precise subject in order to protect values that are fundamental for this perspective. Again, equality, freedom, or more precisely, autonomy and predictability. And this alliance between the indigenous anthropological model and liberal multiculturalism provides this very stable subject that is needed by law, international law, and national domestic legal systems. Now, what are the problems with this dominant discourse? The first one is that this discourse invisibilizes urban Indians. And as I said before, today, mostly half of the people that describe themselves as Indians live in urban contexts. So this discourse that argues that it is able to describe in precise way the life of indigenous groups is incapable of doing that for half of the population that believe that they belong to this kind of cultural communities. The second big problem of this dominant discourse is that the invisibility of urban Indians is that this incentive to the undertaking of research aimed at understanding and evaluating the social, cultural, economic, and political characteristics and dynamics of these subjects and their communities. If you go to the web, or if you go to a library here in the US, and you try to look for the bibliography on urban Indians, you will see that it is very limited. It's radically limited. And in that way, it is very difficult to understand who are urban Indians. And more precisely, who are these persons that constitute 50% in average of the persons that recognize themselves as belonging to indigenous communities? And the third and last problem of this dominant discourse is that since we don't know who these communities are, we don't know if they should be entitled to group-differentiated rights. We don't have precise descriptions of these communities that allow us to think from a legal and philosophical point of view about the rights that they should or that they should not have. In that way, the interests, needs, and legal protection for those justifiable needs and interests cannot be articulated. Now, finally, from my perspective, we need a new set of conceptual tools to describe in more precise ways this diversity that exists within Aboriginal groups all over the world, clearly all over the Americas. And from my point of view, the following topology might help to describe in more precise way this type of diversity. I am not saying that this typology can cover all the possible urban Indians that exist today, but I would argue that this typology can describe the majority of urban Indians at least in the Americas. The first category of this typology is what I call traditional urban Indians. These communities inhabit their ancestral lands, but these lands are not rural anymore. They have been absorbed by towns or cities of the dominant culture. The members of these Indian communities are part of the market economy. Most have little or no knowledge of their traditional language, and their connections with their traditional culture are, in general, weak. However, the community wants to remain a specific collectivity separate from the dominant culture. The second category is what I call metropolitan Indians. These are collectivities who describe themselves as Indian, but who inhabit cities that are not located in their ancestral territories. These communities migrated from their traditional territories to flee from violence, to seek new economic opportunities, or as a consequence of cultural assimilation policies promoted by the state. Most of their members were born in the city and have become integrated into the market economy. Most of those who make up this kind of Indian urban community do not speak their traditional language, nor do they know the cultural traditions of their ancestors. However, they do have a common past, which is partially different from that of the majority culture. They also recognize and value their connections with the traditions of their ancestors and want to maintain a relatively extensive space where they can manifest and reproduce their diversity. And finally, the third category of this typology is what I called urban Indians in transit. These are communities or individuals who settled for short periods of time in cities. Their permanence in the city or in cities is directly related to a particular objective. Think, for example, in members of Aboriginal communities that work for NGOs in the cities, or young individuals that recognize themselves as Indians that go to study in high schools or universities in the cities. After the completion of this objective, it is clear that they will return to their ancestral territories. Now, as you can see, my main arguments are descriptive, analytical, and critical. I don't defend a normative perspective in this presentation, and I don't defend one in the paper in which this presentation is based. And what I try to do is to present, in order to recognize it, the dominant framework to understand indigenous groups. I try to show what are the weaknesses of this dominant discourse, particularly with regard to the consequences that this discourse has for Indian identity. Again, it essentializes, it territorializes, it ecologizes, and it homogenizes Indian identity. And finally, what I tried to do was to offer some categories that might make explicit the diversity that exists within Aboriginal communities all over the world. Thank you.